Good evening, everybody. So I'm going to talk to you about water, and I promise it will not take over an hour. So we are deeply connected to water in so many different ways. You could even say our spirit is entwined with water. Who can't see a calm lake and feel a deep sense of serenity? Or wonder in the majesty of a great waterfall, feel refreshed with a dip in the pool on a hot day, or understand the terror of something like a tsunami? Water is diverse, powerful, and essential. You can't have great coffee without great water. I'll let these famous explorers tell you another important thing about water.
The universal translator is coming online, sir.
Ugly, ugly, giant bag of mostly water.
Bags of mostly water. An accurate description of humans, sir.
This is true. We are mostly water. So when we're talking about water, we're talking about us. Many of our great landscapes were carved by water. The Great Lakes were carved out by the retreating glaciers at the end of the last ice age. Water has, in fact, dictated the rise and fall of many of the great civilizations in our history. A few examples here. The ancient pharaohs derived a lot of their power because of their knowledge and ability to manipulate, in some ways, the flooding of the Nile River that deposited silt on the agricultural lands there and produced all of the grain, which kept that civilization going. The ancient Romans were some of the great water engineers of history. You're probably familiar with the aqueducts, like what is pictured here. But they also invented water mills, water mining. And in fact, they did something with water that we got away from, and we're just starting to get back to this idea today of using different streams of water for different purposes. So they had different water going into their fountains than they had going into their bathhouses. This was a great idea, which we don't do anymore, and it's an important one that we will, as I said, be getting back to. The ancient Chinese, it was the Grand Canal connecting the Yangtze and Yellow Rivers in the north and south of China that allowed them to move grain between those two river systems and keep their armies unified and brought together that empire. So one of the lessons we can learn from history is that civilizations that rely too long on old water technology are routinely overtaken by those that innovate to take advantage of water's opportunities and challenges. This is a lesson that we should learn. Another important point from history, historians will tell you that Europe's lack of a major inland water system, there's no Yangtze or Ganges or Tigris and Euphrates in Europe, led to the rise of independent, small independent nations and ultimately the rise of liberal democracy. So in a sense, you can attribute democracy to water. Water has also driven a number of revolutions. It was transoceanic sailing that globalized civilization. Water wheels launched the Industrial Revolution. Watt's steam engine revolutionized transportation and industry. Sanitation of our water system extended human lifetimes by decades. Great dams like Hoover Dam, pictured here, finally gave mankind control over the fickle precipitation of Mother Nature, limiting both flooding and droughts. That allowed food production to increase, while at the same time giving you hydroelectric electricity. That is one of the reasons that the United States rose as a global power. And intermodal shipping containers have revolutionized global commerce. About 90% of commerce occurs on the water in our oceans. Water also controls our weather. So water comes into our lives in so many central ways. Let me ask you a question to test your knowledge on water here. So we use a lot of water in this country. Who do you think is the largest withdrawer? Where does most of our water get withdrawn in this country? Anybody? Agriculture was what I was expecting you to say. That's where most of our water is used, but I chose my words carefully here. I said withdrawn. Power plants. Power plants in our country withdraw over 200 billion gallons of water a day. And that's used in part to boil that water by burning coal or natural gas or nuclear heat or whatever to make steam, to turn turbines and make electricity. but also for cooling of those power plants. And so they return a lot of that water back to the lake or river that it came from, so it's not used in the sense that it is in agriculture, but they do withdraw much more than we do for agriculture. So that's one intimate connection between water and energy, that we use so much water to make the energy that we all use. But you can flip that around, too, and say, where does most of our energy go? Well, it turns out that the biggest user of our electricity is actually water treatment, distribution, and use. So it goes both ways. Energy and water are so interconnected that there's a name for it. It's called the water-energy nexus. And Argonne National Laboratory is a Department of Energy laboratory, so you might ask, why are we talking about water? Here's a big reason why we're talking about water, because water and energy are inextricable. In fact, here's a report that you can grab from online if you've got nothing to do for a few hours that was just published recently, see, in 2014, that really highlighted a lot of these interconnections between energy and water. I've just mentioned a few here, but there are many, many more. Okay, so water's clearly important, but it's invisible. Water is actually hidden all around us, even in this room. Let me give you an example. If you take 683 gallons of water, that actually is 683 gallons. I'll wait while you count them. So if you take 683 gallons of water, you can grow 6 pounds of alfalfa hay. If you take those 6 pounds of alfalfa hay and you feed them into a machine that looks like that, it will give you 1 gallon of milk. So in that single gallon of milk sitting in your fridge are represented almost 700 gallons of water. It's not just milk. It's all of the food that we use. A single grape, not a bunch of grapes, one grape, is about a third of a gallon of water. One walnut, almost 5 gallons. One potato, nearly 7. A cup of coffee, and this isn't a venti latte frappuccino, we're talking about just a cup of coffee with nothing in it, is 37 gallons. If you do make it a latte, it's going to go way up, because as I explained a moment ago, dairy has a lot of embedded water in it. A single Greek yogurt is about 90 gallons. And the biggest culprit here would be meat, especially beef, which represents, in the case of a hamburger, over 600 gallons of water. But it's not just food. It's also the materials that we use. Steel. To make steel, you need water. To make 1 pound of steel, which is not a very big piece of steel, it would take 11 gallons of water. And this is true of all the other materials that we use. Plastic, cement, cotton, paper, all of them take water to make. What that means is that the clothes that you're all wearing, the phone that's in your pocket, the car that you drove to get here, all of those things have within them virtual water. So globally, we don't move water from one part of the world to another in any appreciable amount because the scales of water that we use are ginormous. To give you an example of that, the Jardine Water Plant here outside of Chicago processes as much water in one day as the entire volume of petroleum we use in the United States in that day. So that's the type of scales we're talking about. So you're not going to move that type of volume from one point to another, and I'll talk more about that later. But we do move virtual water around because all of the goods that we're shipping around the earth have within them, as I just described, embedded water. And so there are folks who have looked at this and kind of tracked. There are countries that are net exporters of virtual water and countries that are net importers of virtual water. And perhaps it's not surprising when you see, for example, North Africa and the Middle East are net importers of virtual water. They're not bringing in water, but they're bringing in an awful lot of food, for example. And so we're moving a lot of water around, not all of which is sustainable water, and we're not policing this in any organized way. This is a policy problem that is going to have to be addressed going forward. Let me just give you one example. There's a company based in Saudi Arabia called Al Marai, which I'm told, I don't speak Arabic, but I'm told that means the pasture. There's no pasture in Saudi Arabia. The pasture in this case is in the American Southwest. So Al Marai is the largest vertically integrated dairy company in the world. And what they do is they extract groundwater in the Southwest. We'll get to groundwater a little bit later. And they use that to grow hay. And then they ship that hay to the dairy cows in the Mideast to make the dairy to use there. So they're actually moving massive amounts of groundwater, effectively, from the American Southwest which is, as I'll describe, not sustainable, to another part of the world. These are things that we need to start paying much more attention to. So water is important, but in fact, it's becoming even more important as we go forward in time. So we don't have a shortage of water on Earth. There's an enormous amount of water on Earth, but unfortunately, the vast majority of it is in the oceans, salt water, which we can't use for much of anything in that form. So it's actually about 97% of the water on Earth is in our oceans, which translates to 350 quintillion some gallons. A lot of water. But you can't drink that stuff. You can't water your crops with it. You can't even put it through a power plant, in fact. The water that we all deal with is the fresh water, which represents less than 3% of the water on Earth. So how is this fresh water distributed, this less than 3% of the water? Well, there's the water that we see that, you know, evaporates, ends up in the clouds, comes down as rain and snow, and we see that in forms like Lake Michigan out there. That I would call renewable runoff. Some of that water is going to percolate down through the ground and form groundwater, aquifers. And as long as you withdraw that water at a slower pace than it's being replenished, it would be renewable. Of course, that's not what we're doing, though. In almost every case, when we start tapping these aquifers, we're withdrawing the water at a much faster rate than it's being replenished. And so in that sense, it's not truly renewable. There are other aquifers in the ground that are sometimes called fossil water, akin to fossil fuels. And it's not fossil in the sense like fossil fuels where it's made of fossilized organisms, but in the sense that it's been there for a really, really long time and is not being replenished at all. In some cases, hundreds of thousands of years, maybe even millions of years, some of these aquifers, when you tap those, that is a one-time use resource. An example of that, Libya. Libya built something called the Great Man-Made River, where they ran under the Sahara to bring fossil water for them to use for all the things we use water for. And they spent $32 billion building that Great Man-Made River, and the projections are that it will only last about 20 years. At that point, they've expended that resource. So how is this less than 3% of water distributed? Well, all that stuff we see is only actually about 0.3% of the less than 3% of the water on Earth. About 30% of that less than 3% is in that groundwater. And I'm assuming you guys can do the math and see that that doesn't total up to 100. Where is the rest of that fresh water? It's locked up in places where we can't get at it. Things like glaciers and the permafrost and so on. So the amount of water we're talking about that we all use is actually a tiny fraction of that massive amount of water on Earth. What's worse is that that resource is becoming even smaller. One of the reasons is because of climate change. So moment of self-promotion, that's a picture of a book that I wrote with a colleague at Argonne, How to Change Minds About Our Changing Climate, which combats all of the myths that you hear out there from the denial or skeptic community. One of the effects of climate change is that glaciers are melting. All over the planet, glaciers are melting. That's been very well documented now. The reason that's a big concern is that glaciers like those in the Tibetan Plateau in the Himalayas, the annual melt from those glaciers is the source of most of the major river systems in Asia. So the Indus and the Ganges and the Yangtze and the Yellow, all those rivers, that's where they get their water from. So when those glaciers disappear, those rivers are going to dry up. And that water is the source of water for about 1.5 billion people on Earth and growing. So where are all those people going to get water when those glaciers are gone or when they've shrunk enough that there's not enough water there? I don't have an answer for you. There's another issue with climate disruption, which is that we're getting more severe droughts than we've ever witnessed before. So this is well known to folks who live in California now and all of us who buy the produce that is grown there. But other parts of the world too. The drought that's in the Middle East is said to be the worst in 900 years. And people will tell you that that drought led to food shortages, which has led to a lot of the civil unrest that's in that part of the world right now. What's going on in Syria was in part fed by food shortages, leading to refugee crises and everything else. So We've got a serious supply problem with water. It's a tiny supply, and it's shrinking. What about demand? Well, bad news there, too. Turns out demand is skyrocketing for water because of population growth and development. We just start using more water. Because remember, it's not just bathing and brushing your teeth and whatever. Anything you use, remember, has water in it. So as people start to have more things, that means they need more water. So it's projected that over the next 35 years, by the year 2050, global demand will rise at least 55%. So we've got shrinking supply, growing demand for a resource that we depend on for almost everything in our life. So what does that mean? It means that just like in the previous century where oil conflicts governed our geopolitics, in this century it's going to be water. We are going to have water-based conflicts, which are going to shape our century. And this is already happening. The Aral Sea is all but dried up in Central Asia, so the Fergana Valley is no longer fertile in the way it once was, and all of those Central Asian countries are sniping with each other now about those limited resources that are left. Same is going on in intrastate conflict in India. Another example from South America, the Salala River that flows from Bolivia into Chile. It goes into the Atacama Desert there, one of the driest places on Earth, and they need it for their mining operations in the Atacama Desert, which is one of the foundations of the Chilean economy. But that they want those water resources, but the Bolivians need them too, and if the Bolivians take more of that water, less of it gets to Chile, and so there's conflict between them now. The Nile Basin has been a source of water-based conflict since, as I told you, the time of the pharaohs, but this is still true today. You have countries on the tail end of the Nile, like Egypt, that rely on the Nile, but those headwaters are in Ethiopia and Kenya. And so that continues to be a source of struggle. And we all are familiar with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. A lot of folks don't realize, though, that a big piece of that conflict revolves around the limited water resources in that region. Those draft agreements that get written up once in a while to find a peaceful solution, a chunk of that paperwork is actually devoted to water. So water is surely the most important material in the world. But as I told you, water is invisible. And this is not good for us or for water. So why is water so invisible? I think a good explanation for that is that for a long time, at least in the developed world, we've been living in what I call the golden age of water. So what do I mean by the golden age of water? When you're in the golden age, you have three things all at the same time. You have water that is abundant, safe, and cheap. When you have all three of those, you kind of start ignoring water. It doesn't seem so precious or rare anymore. It leads to things like this. If you stayed at a Four Points hotel a few years ago, the little water bottle that was in your room came with a placard on it that said that. It's water. Of course it's free. Which is, they were trying to make fun of the hotels that charge you $5 for a bottle of water. But what they're really doing is they're tapping into something primal about our relationship with water. We feel like it should be free. Why would I pay for water? And this mentality of, well, water should be free, there's plenty of it out there and it's safe and whatever, leads us to do things like this. Here in America, we flush almost 6 billion gallons of perfectly fresh drinking water down the toilet every day, literally. This is because you have one pipe of water coming into your house, and that water is drinkable. And you use that same water to flush your toilet or to drink or to wash your clothes or to water your lawn or whatever else you're doing with water. Remember the Romans. They were the ancient Romans. They had a better idea. You don't need to use the same quality of water for every purpose. It's time for us to start rethinking that. So how else do we waste water these days? Well, a lot of this is invisible to us under the ground in our water infrastructure, all those water mains. So you don't see them because they're under the streets and sidewalks, but they're in terrible condition. Many of them were built, you know, a century ago, and they're falling apart. So we spend tons of energy and other resources getting water so it's drinkable, cleaning up all the junk that ends up in water, and pumping it out into those water mains, and then one in every 6 of those gallons of water is just lost to leaks in those pipes underground because there are so many. Speaking of our infrastructure, tell you how underfunded that problem is. We actually spend about as much buying bottled water in this country as we do maintaining our entire water infrastructure, all the treatment plants, all those water mains, all of it. This is something like a $1 trillion infrastructure need that we have, and we're vastly underspending. How else is water disrespected? This isn't true so much here in the United States, but when you look globally, about 80% of sewage is just discharged untreated back into waterways. You can imagine the problems that that leads to with disease. Hydraulic fracturing impacts our water in many different ways negatively. Agricultural runoff. We put all this fertilizer on our crops with nitrogen and phosphorus and so on, and then either from irrigation or precipitation, a bunch of it gets washed away, ends up in places like the Gulf of Mexico. You get big algal blooms and dead zones. Huge problem in our waterways today. Heavy metals. This is familiar to anyone in Flint, Michigan these days, or anyone who reads the news, but there are plenty of other ways that heavy metals get into our water. What's pictured here was is a river in Colorado where, you might remember, it was maybe a year or two ago, the EPA accidentally released a bunch of water from a mine that was heavily polluted with heavy metals, and that was the actual color. That's not a false color. That was the color of the river after all those metals ended up in there. We also have lots of pathogens in our water, thanks to, in part, that untreated sewage. Another interesting thing that ends up in our water are these guys, so-called micropollutants. You can take water from your tap and find pretty much all of these things in there, even after it's gone through the treatment plant. The amounts are tiny. They're not relevant necessarily to us, but they're in there. So we are all taking Prozac and birth control in every glass of water. Maybe that's a good thing. So again, these amounts are not high enough to affect us, but they do start affecting ecologies. There have been studies showing some fish species that are affected by those hormones and they're not reproducing properly anymore, for example. So this golden age of water is ending. And this is going to reshape how we all live. It's going to change how our food is raised, how our communities are organized, and in fact, how our entire economy functions. So in the golden age, we had abundant, cheap, and safe. And you're probably going to be able to get 2 out of 3 in most cases. You can have water that's abundant and cheap if you haven't spent any energy cleaning it up, but you're probably not going to want to drink that stuff. You can have water that's abundant and safe if you spend a fortune cleaning it, like the state-of-the-art desalination plant pictured here. Or you can have cheap and safe water, but just not enough of it. Think California drought right now. So all of those are going to be situations of water crisis, which certainly is going to be happening a lot in the future. But if you look around the world, water crisis is already happening in many places. So on the next slide, to me, is the scariest statistic I show in any talk that I give. This, every time I read it, is amazing to me. Every 90 seconds, a child somewhere dies because of a water-related disease. Every 90 seconds. Think about how many children will be dead by the time we walk out of this room. There's no reason for this to be happening in 2016. Millions of Indian girls and elsewhere, this is true in Africa and many other places too, are trapped by water. And what do I mean by that? They don't have water in their homes. They've got to go get water from some source, a well or otherwise, which on average is well over a mile away from their home. So what that means is all the water you have to use for everything, sanitation, washing your clothes, cooking, you name it, whatever you're going to use water for, every drop needs to be carried on their head from that site over a mile away. That takes so long to do that every day, they don't go to school. They never get to enter the economy and participate like their male siblings. This is another thing that needs to change. So you may have heard the famous quote, all politics is local. I like to say, all water is local. So I told you we can't move water easily from one region to another. And water needs vary dramatically as you look around the world because of precipitation and population and other things. But even if a water-poor region of the world wanted to buy water from us here, from our Great Lakes, we can't get it to them. You can't get enough water from Lake Michigan to Haiti or somewhere else where they would want water because you just can't move enough. So why don't we have these water pipelines to try and make it more equitable, the distribution of water? So one of the reasons, a very big reason, is the volumes involved, as I described earlier. You'd have to move a ridiculous amount of water, probably not even feasible to move that type of water over really large distances. But there's another problem. So what is water worth? That's kind of actually a hard thing to calculate, but here's some rough numbers for you. It depends what you use it for, first of all. If you're going to use it to grow crops, it's going to be a few tens of dollars per what's called acre foot of water. You probably haven't heard of the unit an acre foot. An acre foot is the amount of water that would cover 1 acre of land 1 foot deep, which is about over 300,000 gallons of water. So it's a lot of water. And all it's worth, agriculturally speaking, is a few tens of dollars. If you're using it in your home, that value might be about $1,000. So we do have pipelines for another liquid, oil, which we move over large distances. Why do we do that? Because that's what an acre foot of oil is worth. That was actually before the recent drop in oil prices, so let's say 250 or 300,000. But you get the picture. The economics just don't make sense to do the same thing with water. So, as I said, we all feel like water should be cheap or maybe even free. But there's this great quote from Ben Franklin. When the well is dry, we learn the worth of water. Oil is substitutable. Water is not. Okay, so you came to hear some science. What is water? So that's water. What's the chemical formula for water? H2O. It's the one molecule everybody knows. But maybe there's something you didn't know about water. So this is what the molecule looks like. The O, oxygen, is the red guy in the middle. And the H, the two hydrogens, are on the two sides. What's important about this molecule is the way it's shaped. Those two hydrogen atoms are not in a straight line with the oxygen, with one on each side. They're both on the same side, like Mickey Mouse ears. And that's a really important thing about water, because oxygen likes negative charge more than the hydrogen does. And so the electrons that are flying around that molecule distribute themselves asymmetrically. There's more electrons on one side than on the other side. And so you get something called polarity, where the molecule is more positive over here and more negative over here. And that one aspect of water, the fact that it's polar, controls so many of the things, the interesting and important properties about water. For one thing, that's what allows microwave ovens to work. The reason they work is the microwaves come through and they cause those polar molecules to rotate and vibrate around, and that's what heats up your food. More importantly, water's polarity is what drives proteins to fold. So the proteins that make up you and me and every living thing on Earth are folded up in very complex ways, these big molecules, and all of those folding interactions are mediated by water. If it were not polar, this would not happen. There would be no life. Another strange thing about water's polarity is that it causes solid water, ice, to be less dense than liquid water, water. That is really unusual for a material. There are only a handful of examples of all the materials in the world that we know of where this is true, and water is one of them. That's why ice floats in your glass of water, because it's less dense than the water. And the same thing happens on Lake Michigan in the winter. This is important, that when it freezes in the winter, it freezes at some of the water, that ice sits on the top because it's less dense, and that serves as an insulating barrier to keep the entire lake from freezing during the winter, so you can have life in that water year-round. Again, without that, we might not have life on Earth at all. Another thing about water's polarity is that it makes it a fantastic solvent. Polar molecules are really good at dissolving stuff. So you can put all kinds of different things into water and it'll stay there. And that is also really important for us. Pictured here in the background, way too small for you to see, is just a piece of the metabolism that happens inside our bodies. There are thousands and thousands, probably millions of different chemicals inside us, going through all kinds of different chemical reactions all the time inside our cells. And all of them are dissolved in water. That's the solvent. So all of those things need to be dissolved by just one thing. But the fact that it's a great solvent has an unfortunate side effect, which means it's very easy to pollute. It can dissolve the stuff we want, but it also dissolves all kinds of stuff you don't want to stay in the water. Heavy metals, you know, all those micropollutants I was talking about and plenty of other things, once they get in the water, they stay in the water. Okay, so that's some bad. A good news piece of water is that you can't use up water. The water that's on Earth has been here since long before we were here, and it'll be here long after we're all gone. There are still competing theories about where all the water came from originally on Earth. Extraterrestrial sources are recognized as probably one of the significant original sources, but that all happened way early in our planet's history, and that water just keeps going around through a cycle, right? You learned about this in grade school, where water evaporates and then it rains down, and it just keeps going through a cycle. So it's the same water. What that means is that every molecule of water in every glass that you drink has at some point in its life been inside an oak tree. It's been blasted out by a volcano, and it's been urinated by a dinosaur. Which sounds gross, that we're all drinking dinosaur pee. But what that actually tells you is another important thing about water, which is that no matter how dirty you make it, it can always be cleaned again. It doesn't matter what you put in that water, you can get it back out again if you put in the right effort. So, clean water. What does that mean to say water is clean? That's actually a really complicated question because, as I said, you can put all kinds of different things into water. And you might say, well, let's just take it all out. So all that's left is H2O. You don't want that. You don't want to drink that. That's actually poison, pure, pure water. It'll leach out nutrients from your body. So you don't want it to be that clean. The point is, you want the water to be the appropriate cleanliness for the application that it's going to be used. If you're going to drink it, you want it to be pretty clean. You don't want viruses or heavy metals or certain things in there. But you do need some minerals to be in there, like I said, so it's actually not unhealthy to drink. There are other things where the water can be dirtier. If you're just going to water your lawn, it doesn't need to be drinking water quality. Or, on the flip side, if you're going to manufacture semiconductors, like what's inside your smartphones and laptops and all that, you do need that water to be ultra, ultra clean, cleaner than drinking water. In fact, much cleaner than drinking water. So, in fact, the most state-of-the-art water purification plants in the world are at semiconductor manufacturing. So the idea here is you make the right water for the right purpose. It's called fit for use. And again, the ancient Romans did this a long time ago. It's time to start doing it again. So how do you clean water? There are lots of ways to clean water. This is just a few examples. There are more. So one way is you can do media filtration. This is an old school technique. You basically have a big barrel of sand, and you just pour your dirty water over the top and let it come out the bottom. And it's not the sand per se that's doing the cleaning. On the sand grows a biofilm with lots of little bacteria and stuff in it that chew up all the, not all, but a lot of the bad stuff that's in the water. So as it percolates through, it gets cleaned up. What happens in most of our municipal plants is that mouthful up at the top there, coagulation, flocculation, sedimentation, filtration, which I won't go through the time to describe what that whole process is, but that's how most of our municipal water gets cleaned. Under your kitchen sink, you might have something that looks like that picture over on the right-hand side, membrane filtration. And in fact, that's an area where most of the exciting research, at least in my view, in water technology is these days, is in membrane filtration. I think there are great opportunities to push that technology forward. Other techniques that are out there are things like distillation. This is where you basically boil the water and then recondense it, and then it comes out much cleaner than it was before and leaves behind all the impurities. And you can also disinfect water just to get rid of the pathogens. You can do that with chlorination, dumping in chlorine. That's what we do in most of our municipal systems. You can also do it with ultraviolet light, like what's pictured there, which in some places in the developing world is also used in municipal water treatment systems. So this brings me to back to the issue of our oceans. I told you we don't have a water shortage. It's just that most of it is in the oceans. So we do know how to take seawater and make fresh water. It's a process called desalination, and it's come a long way. People have gotten pretty good at desalination. But I want to give you a sense for the scale of the problem here. This is a plot of the global capacity for desalination by year. So the units here are millions of cubic meters per day that are processed in desalination. And you can see every year the capacity grows. We're building more and more desalination plants, so that's great. And it's maybe not surprising the countries that are leading the way here are places like Israel and United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia and places that are near salt water and are very dry. But let me tell you the scale of the problem here. Look where we are today. Top of that scale is 140 in these units, right? So I'm going to take that graph and I'm just going to squish it down. So that's the same graph, but just squished down. That's our global water use. So you can see how far we have to go if we're going to try and use this to solve our problem. That's not going to get us out of this mess anytime soon. An awful long way to go. Okay. So you may not realize, but here in Chicagoland, we actually have a long history of very impressive water engineering. So long time ago, if you walked out on the streets of Chicago back in the 1800s, it was a really gross place to be. There was sewage on the streets, horse manure and so on. Just, it was awful. And, you know, for a city aspiring to be a growing metropolitan center, that was not acceptable. So the idea would be water sanitation. You want to put that sewage into sewer lines instead of just out on the street. The problem with Chicago is that because of the soil conditions, you couldn't dig under the buildings and put in sewer lines. It wasn't feasible. So what did Ellis Chesbrough do? He thought, well, I'm going to give Chicago the first sewer system in the United States. No city had it before this. And crazy thought, he said, all right, we can't go under the city. Let's lift up the city. And that's actually what they did. They put jacks under all the buildings and jacked them up and built the sewers underneath. Unbelievable. But they did it, and it worked. So that solved one problem, because now the sewage wasn't on the streets anymore. But you know where those sewers dumped? Into the Chicago River. Where did the Chicago River go? Into Lake Michigan. That's where our drinking water was coming from. Still is coming from. So we were just dumping raw sewage into our drinking water, and people started getting sick. So you might think, well, let's just dump our sewage somewhere else, but no, no, not in Chicago. They said, we're just going to make the Chicago River go the other way. And that's what they did. They actually came in and reversed the flow of the Chicago River, dumped a lot of that nasty stuff into what's now the Sanitarium Ship Canal, which actually runs right by Argonne National Laboratory, and, you know, solved the problem, so to speak. But our great water engineering didn't stop there. There's a more recent example at an even larger scale, I would say. So we have this other problem in Chicago that our sewer system is called a combined system, where we use the same lines to handle what comes out of our house as waste and what goes down the storm drains. So for those who've lived in Chicago a long time, you're familiar with when there's a big storm, you get too much water going into that system for the treatment plant to handle, and the whole thing backs up and it comes up in your basement as untreated sewage, which is not fun for anyone who's experienced it. So enough taxpayers finally got fed up with this that they created what you've probably heard of as the deep tunnel, although maybe you've never seen pictures of it. The official name for it is the Tunnel and Reservoir Plan, or TARP plan. But there's this network of tunnels that are massive. Look at the scale here. That's a guy, to give you a sense for how big this tunnel is. And there's a whole bunch of these things under our city which handle this massive flow when there's a big storm that the treatment plant can't handle as fast as it's coming in. And all those tunnels then dump out into places like this. This is Thornton Quarry. Look at the scale here again. Those are trucks. The people there you can't even see. They're so tiny. That's, I think, the tri-state right up there at the top. This is the largest such reservoir in the world, I believe. So all that water gets tunneled down, dumped into there, and it'll sit there until the treatment plants can catch up and process all that mess and get you back to the normal state of affairs. So we've been thinking about big-scale water engineering in Chicago essentially as long as there's been a Chicago. Let me bring it home a little more, though, to Argonne. So there is a sizable but rapidly growing program in water research at Argonne, which very much is in partnership with the University of Chicago, in fact, principally through the Institute for Molecular Engineering, which is a joint institute between these two great research organizations. So just a few examples of the sort of types of work that are going on in water. One would be, I told you a little earlier about how important policy is, things like virtual water not being policed really at all today. The policymakers need to have the right information to understand what policies to put into place, and that's something that smart scientists and engineers can provide. We're also looking at connections between water and the environment in many ways, and food. So top three challenges we face as a society are energy, water, and food. And they're all connected with each other. It's not just a water-energy nexus, it's a water-energy-food nexus. So we can get a lot smarter. So you guys answered correctly about where most of our water is used, not withdrawn. Most of it's withdrawn for the power plants, but most of it is used for agriculture. So that's where, if you're going to try and save some water, that's a good place to turn. And we're not very smart about the way we water our crops. We basically just dump water across an entire farm, more or less the same. What you can do instead is something called site-specific crop management, or precision agriculture, where you go in and you deliver just the right amount of water to even each plant, and just at the right spot by its roots. The Israelis are really good at this already. This is something that we're learning much more about. Another interesting topic of research at Argonne is groundwater dating. So I told you earlier about groundwater and fossil water and how a lot of it's been down there for a really long time. How do you know how long that water's been down there to know how quickly an aquifer is getting replenished? It's actually a really hard question to answer. So the way that we're trained in school that you date old things is carbon dating, right? That's what's used for old human artifacts. Carbon dating doesn't work for things that are hundreds of thousands or even millions of years old. You need some other technique. And so at Argonne, they've developed something called atom trap trace analysis to use krypton dating, and they've actually gone and started dating different aquifers, and they can tell you this one is 600,000 years old, and that one is 200,000 years old. Really important information. We're also developing all kinds of advanced materials technologies to tackle problems of pollution. In my own group, we're doing things to, for example, clean up oil spills with some advanced materials, and developing, I told you, membranes are where most of the exciting new water technology is coming. We're developing all kinds of advanced membrane technologies at Argonne that clean themselves and effectively filter out pathogens and all kinds of other things. Okay, so we face a lot of huge societal challenges. There's climate change, there's income inequality in our financial system, and so on and so forth. A lot of these big challenges, it's really hard to muster affection for them. The financial system, maybe the University of Chicago is the wrong place to say this, but it's really hard to muster affection about the financial system. But our affection for water is something that we're born with. We are all so connected to water that people love water. It is who we are, literally. And water's invisibility, I said, is bad for us and for water. The fact that we have this innate affection for it is good for us and for water. And we need to start reevaluating water's importance. It's important for our foreign policy, our food, the environment around us, public health, our national security, and as I told you, it's intimately connected to energy. It connects to our lives in so many different ways. So water may be invisible, but I would encourage you to start seeing water. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
I was aware of the technology of desalination, but I'm concerned. How is that economically feasible? And what do you think about the future to make it more economically feasible for poor countries in Africa and South Asia?
Okay, so desalination. So I mentioned one thing is that we've got a long way to go with it in terms of scale, right? So it's very important in places like Israel, for example, but globally the scale is essentially irrelevant at this point. So let me talk about technology and science first with desalination. So you can calculate by the laws of physics, thermodynamics, how much energy it takes to take the salt out of seawater to give you drinking water. It's some amount of energy. And it used to be, a few decades ago, that the desalination technology was a long way away from that limit. When they would use, there are still plants operating in places like Saudi Arabia that essentially do distillation. It's very energy intensive. But the state-of-the-art plants, reverse osmosis plants, which is what people are building today, are so good that they're actually approaching those fundamental limits in how efficient it could ever be. So there's actually no breakthrough coming in you know, energy savings for desalination. And by the way, that is what limits how much you can desalinate. You talk about the cost. That's where the cost is primarily, is in the energy to build up the pressure to shove the salt water through those membranes and get the salt out. And energy just costs money. So there's no breakthrough coming there. It's never going to get a lot cheaper than it is today. It'll get a little bit cheaper as people get a little better at it, but there's no breakthrough there. What I just said is true for seawater, but the story changes for brackish water, which is less salty water. And there's a lot of brackish water on Earth in aquifers, for example. Many places where there's fossil fuels, there's also water, but the water's a little salty. Not as salty as seawater, but it's too salty to drink. And desalinating that, there's all kinds of exciting technological innovations that are yet to be made. There's all kinds of room for improvement there. So don't give up on desalination altogether. I'm just saying there's not a breakthrough in seawater desalination. In terms of cost, the Israelis pay more for water than we do because it's expensive to desalinate because of the energy. And there's really no way around that. What I would argue, though, is we're not actually paying as much for water here as we should be. There's not really intelligent water pricing much of anywhere on Earth today, which I tried to allude to a few times. That will help us start making smarter decisions with how we use water if it has an appropriate price on it. The flip side of that is you can argue that water is a human right. You can't charge people for water if they can't afford to buy enough to live. That's inhuman. And so how do you balance those two things? And there's another issue. So there's, you know, Adam Smith's Invisible Hand, University of Chicago, we can talk about this, that, you know, uses market forces to try and solve your problem. So you come up with a price, and you say that's the price, and then let the market solve your problem. But all that does is make sure that we humans share our water in a certain way that maybe makes sense. The problem is we're not the only ones who need water. The ecosystem around us needs water, too. The rest of the Earth needs a lot of water to grow the trees and all the other things that happen on Earth that need water, all the other organisms, and they don't pay water bills. So there has to be another hand that comes in with Adam Smith's invisible hand, a green hand, if you will, that represents the, you know, the Lorax, speaks for the trees.
I have a question for you. Who cares? You know, so we, you know, you've alluded to the crisis that, you know, that we've all heard about in Flint. The World Health Organization came out with a statement that reverse osmosis systems are actually really bad in their current form, perhaps, for health. And in fact, there are stories out there of children drinking formula based on reverse osmosis systems who actually got really sick. The city of Chicago school system finally came out and said, oh no, we haven't been testing for lead.
Yep.
So my question is,
this is true.
And who cares? So you've been in this field. Can you tell us who cares?
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, well, you're all here because you care, right? So this is something we're trying to spread the word about, is the importance of water. That's why I'm up here talking and why I give other talks just like this, is that I think you're right, that this is a crisis that certainly the folks of Flint are feeling acutely right now, but in other parts of the world, as I mentioned, children are dying every day because they're consuming water that's not been cleaned, and that's should not be acceptable to any of us. And that is a crisis of leadership, but who elects those leadership? That's us. So it's all of our fault. It's all of our responsibility to fix this.
Hi, I'm just, one of the things that I work with is soil's ability, healthy soil, microbiologically active soil to clean water. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious what Argonne is doing along those lines.
Oh, that's a great question, which I'm not sure I can give you a good answer to. So we have a lot of soil experts at Argonne. I'm familiar with it in the context of soil's role in playing with our climate, because soil absorbs carbon and things like that, too. It's one of the carbon sinks, so to speak. I would guess in a laboratory of 3,500 researchers, we probably have people I don't know about who are looking at that problem, but I can't tell you for sure. It's a good point. I'll learn more about it myself.
I'm a big fan of bottled water, which I take a lot of flack for. And I wonder, as a water expert, what's your opinion about bottled water?
Okay. So I have to be careful because I'm drinking from a bottle right here. They gave it to me. I didn't buy it. So bottled water. I understand the convenience of bottled water. And if you live in a home that has lead pipes that you can't afford to replace, I can understand why you would drink bottled water at home. That said, bottled water, generally speaking, is not any safer for you than what comes out of your tap, you know, barring the lead pipe question. In fact, in many cases, bottled water is tap water. So Aquafina and a number of other brands, that's what they just pull off the municipal supply. They maybe run it through one more filter, which doesn't remove anything, and then they sell it back to you in a bottle. And so if you want to pay, you know, whatever, $1 a bottle for what you can get out of your tap for a penny, that's you're free to do so.
You had fracking in your discussion. Can you address two issues here? One, you're talking about a shortage of water, and we're taking, my understanding of fracking is you're taking water, polluting it, dumping it down into the ground, therefore making our short supply of water even less.
Yep.
Second, what about fracking? Do you see is the probability that some of this water going down into the fracking area is going to contaminate the groundwater that you're talking about?
So people are just starting to study that, and I think there are mixed reports. There are places, I suspect it totally depends on the local geology, what the answer to that question is. I think there are places where it doesn't end up getting into the aquifers, and there are places where it does. And so we just need to be a lot smarter and figure that all out before we start doing all those operations, which we're not doing today. And you're right, those types of operations in general, fossil fuel operations, are very water intensive. And also they produce a lot of water. It's called produced and flowback water that comes back up with the fossil fuels. And that water is dirty. It's got salt and hydrocarbons and heavy metals and other junk in it that was down there under the ground. And you know, what do you do with all that water? And right now what they're usually doing is they're just dumping it into a holding pond in many cases, which are not even lined. And so then it just goes back down and might get into aquifers. So, yeah, there's all kinds of challenges there that are going to need to be addressed.
Hi. So Congress is considering a law right now, the Lautenberg Act, to try to give the EPA more authority to regulate chemicals in our water and to try to decrease pollution. If you've heard of this law, do you think it does enough? If not, just what do you think of the current state of the EPA's regulation on chemicals?
Okay, you're stepping outside of my expertise here. I'm not a policy expert, and I'm not even familiar with the law that you just mentioned. It is true that the EPA has some very strict water guidelines across. You can look them up online. I counted one time. I don't remember what it is. There's something like, I don't know, 70 different things that all have, you know, limits, so-called safe limits, that you can't have more than that in your drinking water. And anyone providing public water needs to meet those limits, or else you're in violation of those EPA guidelines. There are, of course, other things which aren't on that list, which may be hazardous, and so then the laws need to be updated. So all I can do is give you that general statement. I don't know enough about that particular legislation to speak about it.
You talked a little bit about climate change, its impact on water. Is there any way to really quantify how much of an impact climate change can have on the cost of water?
Okay, I don't think the cost of water is ever going to go down, and probably nor should it. Quantify the effect is a really hard thing to do. And especially because there's so many ways in which, you know, climate and water are interrelated. I mentioned drought. I mentioned melting of glaciers. Also, sea level rise is pushing salt water into freshwater aquifers, so it's polluting those sources. You know, precipitation changes, extreme weather events are changing the way we interact with water. There are countless examples of interconnections between climate disruption and water, none of which I can think of that are good.
One of the greatest resources we have in Chicagoland is MWRD, and I don't see any mention, except for the TARP there. What is the University of Chicago and Argonne doing? In particular, I'm thinking about, instead of just dumping that treated water from the TARP, for instance, recharging, putting it back into the groundwater.
That's untreated water, so you wouldn't necessarily want to dump untreated water directly back into
it. Okay, you could add a step to the process
treat
it. Okay.
So the MWRD, Metropolitan Water Reclamation District, for those who don't know, they're the folks who clean up the water for us. Very important. And, in fact, Argonne and the University of Chicago and the MWRD and World Business Chicago and a number of other organizations all got together recently recognizing the importance of water, not just from the crisis standpoint, but also from the opportunity, maybe especially from the opportunity standpoint, got together and formed an organization called Current, which is a joint organization that is really looking to enlighten our use of water in this region and to perhaps expand upon it. I mentioned everything around you uses water. There are a lot of industries that are very water intensive, some of which today are located in places where they're using unsustainable water sources. Why can't some of those industries come here to where we're relatively water rich and help our local economy, our regional economy. There are all kinds of opportunities where we can do that.
My question is, what way of life will we see change in the near future because of lack of usable water?
So we are fortunate here in Chicago that we are not going to run out of water anytime soon, right? We sit next to one of the largest sources of fresh water on Earth. It's actually the second largest source. Some people don't realize they talk about it as the largest. There's this very deep, big lake in the middle of nowhere in Russia that's actually got more water in it, but good luck getting to that one. So we're the most accessible largest water source. So yeah, we're lucky here. That doesn't mean that we should be wasteful with our water. We have to take, I said all water is local. We need to take responsibility for our own water just like everybody else. And we can use it as the resource that it is, the valuable resource that it is. As I said, starting to bring in industries that can use that water as long as they're using it responsibly. But the water in Chicago is just absurdly abused. You've probably all seen the lawn sprinklers on in the middle of the rain. And in many cases, that's because most households are not even metered for their water use, right? So there's no mechanism in place to control people's behavior, to use things responsibly. So I believe that's all going to change going forward, where people will be metered and there will be an appropriate price, which will then give us the signals to start behaving properly in the way that we use water.
My first question is, if we used our water 100% efficiently, how many people could we support off of our current supplies? Second question is, how close are we in percentage-wise to that efficiency? And the third is, as climate change happens, are there any places that can look to gain more water thanks to changing climate patterns?
Yeah. I'm only going to be able to give sort of broad answers to those. I'll start with the last one first. So, yes, climate change is going to move precipitation around. There are regions that will get wetter on average and regions that will get drier on average. But those regions that will get wetter, which you might think, well, that's good, they have more water, it's going to tend not to come in those nice, steady, even rains that are so good for things like agriculture. It's going to come as storms more often, and then a dry spell, and then a storm. So overall, you're getting more water per year, but it's not coming down in a way that you can use as effectively. So I'm not sure that anyone really gains so much in any region in terms of climate. The amount of water on Earth is not changing. So we've got enough water. The question is, how much can we afford to clean, to make usable for people to use? And I don't see a limit to that, per se, right? So that all comes down to the societal will to invest our resources in that instead of somewhere else. And the main limiting factor there comes down to energy, which is money. So it really connects back to the energy problem. If we can come up with cheaper, more abundant sources of energy that don't drive climate disruption, that helps you solve the water problem in a big way.
My question is, how sustainable is the meat industry in that, you know, we're seeing droughts in California, polluting the water, et cetera. And in the Midwest, we're growing feed for animals, which is being subsidized.
Yeah, yeah. General statement, a vegetarian or better still, very much better still, vegan diet is enormously more sustainable than a vegetarian or worst case, meat-consuming diet. And that's true for water, but it's also true for all kinds of other resources. It's just meat is very resource-intensive. You can find statistics for all those kinds of things relatively easily online. Now, I don't think that you can regulate what people eat, nor should you. I think that's part of sort of human free will, is we should be allowed to consume what we like, but you can certainly inform people and educate people and maybe price things properly so that, you know, decisions are made. So it's not necessarily about all of us becoming vegans. It's about everybody consuming maybe a little less meat and less dairy, which are so demanding on the precious resources that we have on Earth.
Is thermal pollution, both at the local level from, as you mentioned, for example, energy
production? Yes.
Or also, like, thermal pollution of the oceans a concern or something?
Yeah. So thermal pollution, for those who don't know, that power plant pulls water from a lake or a river, and then, you know, some of it becomes steam and turns the turbines, and some of it, you know, is cooling, and it ends up, a lot of it getting dumped back in the lake or river that it came from, but it ends up being a lot warmer than when it came out. So they're actually heating up the water in their power plant with waste heat. And you might think, well, who cares if the water's a little warmer, but warmer water can't dissolve as much oxygen in it, for example. And so they're depleting oxygen from that water, and there's a lot of stuff that lives in the water that needs that oxygen, and so that's bad. That's thermal pollution, one example of thermal pollution. And yeah, that's an issue that in fact, is something that needs to be paid attention to. And there are various steps you can take, running the water through multiple times, for example, recycling that water. You know, you don't have to dump it all out with one pass. You can go back through, you know, clean it up on site, and just cool it again. Make a closed loop system is one way to solve that problem, and also to help solve other problems associated with that. Another thing I should mention with water effluent, which I didn't, in terms of desalination. So in a desalination plant, you take seawater, which has a certain amount of salt in it, and you're effectively, you know, pulling most of that salt out to make the fresh water. What's left behind is really, really salty water, briny water. And what they do with that is they put it back in the ocean. And if you're not careful in how you do that, you're going to wreak havoc on the aquatic system there, because those fish and everything else that's in that water can't live in that ultra-salty water. And so you have to be, and this has become a problem with certain plants where they've had to come up with ways to fix this. What they'll usually do is they'll run a pipe way out into the ocean with lots of little holes in it, basically. And so it just comes out a little bit here and there, and then it gets, diluted back into just regular old seawater overall relatively quickly. So that's another effluent thing that needs to be paid attention to.
I have a question that goes back to the idea that we live next to this great body of fresh water. I've also seen maps that show that the aquifers and the groundwater depletion in the Chicago and Milwaukee region is something like 900 feet, which is greater than some areas of the Southwest. So is it almost like a false sense of security that we have the lake next to us if what we're doing is we're depleting the groundwater to that extent?
Yeah, it's true that the water table is falling almost everywhere. And so, you know, when people drill wells, they have to keep drilling them deeper and deeper because that groundwater just keeps getting lower and lower as it gets drained. And yes, that is true in places where there's a lot of surface water too, like here in the upper Midwest, but it's especially true in places where that's the primary source of water and it's just disappearing frighteningly fast. So yes, we need to take responsibility for our water use, even though we are comparatively water rich.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Darling.
Where are you?
Right here.
Oh, right there.
To your right. As a nanoscientist, according to your biographical information, are there any revolutionary molecular nano-level prospects that you are working on?
So one example, pathogens in water are a huge problem. That's why every 90 seconds a child dies somewhere in the world. The way that we get rid of pathogens today is usually by dumping chlorine in the water. And that causes all kinds of problems. One of the things it causes is it creates other toxic compounds, which we go through a lot of troubles in our water systems to try and take care of, because that chlorine reacts with various organic compounds and creates all kinds of nasty carcinogenic junk. It's also, chlorinated water can't be put through a reverse osmosis system. It damages the membranes, so you have to take out the chlorine and then put it back in later in the system. So it's not a good solution, and it's not a solution that's available anyway in many parts of the developing world. What would be nice is if you could just filter out those pathogens. Now, we have filters that can do that, like a reverse osmosis filter. A reverse osmosis filter is basically non-porous. Think of it as just a sheet of plastic. And you shove the heck out of that water, it'll go through there, and nothing else except the water will go through there. And so that'll work, but you need an enormous amount of energy to do that. It's overkill to remove pathogens, which are much bigger than something like salt ions, which is what reverse osmosis is, you know, really good at taking out. What you'd like is a filter that had pores in it that were just a little bit smaller than maybe those viruses or cryptosporidium or whatever your parasite or pathogen is, so that it can't go through, but the water can easily go through those comparatively. For a water molecule, a pore like that would be huge. Okay. Those filters are called ultrafiltration or nanofiltration filters. That's sort of the length scale of things like viruses. They're kind of tens of nanometers in scale. There are no good commercial ultrafiltration membranes to filter out all of the pathogens. And the reason is there's pores of all kinds of sizes in those membranes. And so, yes, some of the pores are tiny, but some of them are big enough that the virus will just find its way through. And if you remove half the viruses, that's no good. So what you really want is a membrane where all the pores are the same size and just the right size so that you can easily push water through and you filter out all the pathogens. Long story. We were trying to do that using a technique called self-assembly. There are these polymers that organize themselves into structures that are right on that length scale, just have that right shape and length scale. You can try and build membranes out of those things. We use other technology we've developed at Argonne to make those things be chemically inert and thermally stable and all the other things mechanically robust that you want in a membrane so that we can effectively filter out pathogens. So there's one example for you.
You mentioned every 90 seconds a child dies because of not having access to clean drinkable water. And you also mentioned that having access to clean water is a human right. I noticed you mentioned the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is mostly one portion of it is because of water. And you mentioned how high-tech Israel is in the water desalination. What are your thoughts on Israel cutting off the water supply to the Palestinians, and how is this in compliance with human rights and international law?
Yeah, so we're, again, stepping well outside my area of expertise. A general statement, not to that particular geopolitical situation, is that I do believe water on some level is a human right, and you cannot, this is why we can't just simply throw a price on water and expect that to solve everything, because there are plenty of people living in poverty who just wouldn't be able to afford to live. Everybody needs water. It's one of those few things that you just cannot live without. And so it should not be used as a weapon of war, which, by the way, water has been used as a weapon since humans have been around. Sieges on ancient castles, they would, dump poisonous stuff into the river that was going, into the castle, things like that. I mean, water's been used in war as long as there have been humans. Humans are just awful to each other, and water's so important. If you're going to try and hurt people, that's an effective way to hurt people, which we shouldn't do.
It's policy related, but I'm interested in your perspective as a scientist. One key part to addressing the crisis and just creating better solutions is better policy. And as a scientist and also working with Argonne, how do you feel as if data and new information regarding climate change and particularly water resource management is being received by politicians?
Oh, good question.
And then furthermore, I appreciate you mentioning CURRENT, the organization. What can we do as constituents and scientists even in the room? How can we stay abreast of developments and put the proper pressure on our politicians to create better solutions?
Okay, that was actually a lot of questions.
Just two.
So in terms of staying abreast of the information, there are various resources out there. So, Argonne is building up all of the stuff that goes along with a program, which includes, putting information out there for public consumption. So we're not where we need to be yet, but we're getting there. So bear with us while we, build our own knowledge and coalesce it into a disseminatable form. And your other question, how can you make a difference? Yeah. So, I mean, it's the same issue that comes up with climate change and all kinds of other big societal challenges that we face where we need political action. You vote, number one, but, writing letters, calling, visiting your congresspeople, all of that stuff, that actually matters. When they get letters, they'll actually, they'll weigh them and they'll say, we got 10 pounds of letters, telling us to do this and only 2 pounds telling us to do that. We should probably go with these people. So, just boots on the ground, grassroots efforts can really make a difference. That's why I go out and give these talks. This isn't because I love standing in front of people. It's to try and mobilize folks to actually make a change. Sorry, I think we'll need to stop there.